listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here this week on Every Voice Matters. I'm Dori Francis. We did have a little programming change this week. I know originally we were going to have Trace Embry with Shepherd's Hill Academy with us. And Shepherd's Hill has some major projects going on. They're building and expanding and adding. And Trace just felt like he was really struggling with time. So we went ahead and rescheduled him for October and am fortunate enough to have Shane Gallagher with us today, who's with Wingate Wilderness Therapy in Kanab, Utah. Hi, Shane. Welcome. Thank you for
Hello.
Being. And Shane has worked continuously in the field of outdoor behavioral health care for 30 years, which is just amazing that he's still going. And he's the principal designer and developer of 4 wilderness therapy programs. Currently, he's the co-founder and executive director of Wingate Wilderness Therapy. He also is the author of a book, The Way with Children, Ancient Wisdom for Leading Modern Young People. I can't remember if that's on the website, but if not, I'll make sure that I get that up there for people to find when we link the radio show live. And he and his wife, Sherry, are parents of 6 grown children and 2 grandbabies. It's hard to believe.
Yes.
Thank you, Shane, for being here, for stepping in. I know you just came in from the field.
Yeah. You're very welcome. Glad to.
Welcome that opportunity. Why don't we just start off a little bit with you just sharing with us how you came to have this adventure in life of being in wilderness for 30 years?
Wow. Okay. So the wilderness aspect of wilderness therapy was a surprise to me. The part of like wanting to be helpful to people, you know, when I was a little kid, like toddler and maybe into maybe junior high, grade school, I would say I wanted to be an artist or a drawer. I actually used to say drawer when I was a little kid. I remember specifically writing that drawer, you know, and some gold sheet or something like that. My dad was the art teacher at the high school. And so I think that sort of embedded into my my mind, you know. But then in junior high, I started going into this realm of perhaps wanting to do something. And the only term I had was psychology, you know. So when people asked me what I wanted to do, I was like, well, I think like a psychologist, something like that. And then an interesting, I guess, a phenomenon happened to me. My father passed away when I was a freshman in high school. Mm-hmm. And I obviously that was, you know, really tough. And I also didn't feel like I knew my father very well, you know, that kind of thing. And in his closet, he had a set of philosophy books called the Mental Efficiency Series. Hmm. And they were published in 1914.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And there were these 10 books, you know, that were, you know, 90 some odd years old. And I think he had them there because of the way they looked. But I was like, oh, I wonder if that, you know, I'm going to read these books and then maybe I'll kind of get to know my dad a little bit as a 14-year-old. And I felt super guilty that I didn't take art at my freshman year from my own father. So there was a kind of, I was feeling really challenged there, you know. So a couple things happened. I was completely depressed and felt unworthy of a lot of things, you know, because I didn't take art, you know, from my dad. And then I also read all these books. And by the time I was done, it was like too late. I'm like, I'm a philosopher now. And I really want to be in like the helping field. And then when I was a senior, a buddy of mine, he actually was experiencing a lot of depression as well because he was an athlete and he got injured and couldn't have athletics anymore. And it was this really tough thing for him. And we were talking one night while building the senior class float, you know, for homecoming or something like that. We were talking and he was talking about the struggles he had had both with his injury and with his brother who died when he was a senior in high school right before graduation. And now my friend is a senior and he's like, I'm now the same age and everything. When my brother died back when he was like, eight or something like that, his brother died. And so he's struggling with a lot of things. And I had, you know, Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius and Wayne Dyer and Leo Buscaglia running around in my head, you know? And so I'm like, well, you know, there's this guy named Wayne Dyer. And, you know, Dr. Wayne Dyer had written two books by then. And I'm quoting, you know, your erroneous zones and pulling your own strings. I'm quoting Sky's the Limit also had come out. So I'm quoting from these books and he's like, what? What are you talking about? Nobody talks like this. And I'm like, yeah, but it's so cool because it had helped me, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, reading about Leo Buscaglia's pain from when his wife passed on. He wrote a book, The Way of the Bull, about, you know, 2 years of kind of doing this pilgrimage. And I read that in one sitting on the edge of the Mogollon Rim in Arizona and ending it right as the sun was setting and just crying, you know. I'm like, people figure out how to get past their pain. And I'm like, this is amazing. So I'm explaining this to my buddy, you know, and he's like, people should talk like this. Kids should talk like this. So long story short, we went to the vice principal of the school and we started a club, like Glee Club, the chess club. And we're like, we want to sit in a circle, get like an excerpt from something and read it. And then everybody discuss it. And by that time, as a sophomore, I discovered the Tao Te Ching on accident. I didn't know what it was. I judged a book by its cover and I bought this book that had a cool looking Chinese symbol on it. And I bought six more translations of the Tao Te Ching. I did comparative studies between these translations during my sophomore and junior year. Would make notes, you know, and I'm like, who was this Lao Tzu person? So my friend and I, and a couple other friends, we start this club and some very interesting things happen. One, our cool friends that we all invited stopped coming and sort of a ragtag fugitive fleet of kiddos just came through the door. We had every Thursday evening at 8 o'clock. They literally gave us the key to the school and we would open up one room and put these desks in a circle. And about 25 of us, we would read from some excerpt from one of these.
That's people. Quite a few people. I mean, kids at that age, for that many to show up.
Yeah, it fascinated us all every time people showed up. We were just like, you got to be kidding. And it's like, there's this thirst, you know, and that was back in the late 80s. You know,
yeah, there was a thirst back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so it was this beautiful thing. And I remember one kiddo came, he was a junior. We called him Jamie, and he was fascinated with comic books and writing comic books and illustrating comic books. And he had this dream of one day, you know, doing that. And he made it to every meeting he discussed. It helped him sort of get his goals going in life. And, we called him James. His name is James Owens. He's written a series of books called Here There Be Dragons. And, you know, he's looking at movie deals now. And wow. He looks back to that time of...
I knew you when.
yeah. Like, you know, we were kids and we talked about these sorts of things. And one young woman, at the very end, we had like a final meeting, you know, and how was this for everybody? And one girl, she goes, you know, back from when I was just little, I always had migraine headaches. And I also used to care what people thought about me. I was always very nervous around people. She goes, and this year I have learned to not care. Like my opinion about me is more important and to not be nervous around people and to not this, not that. She goes, I just want everybody to know. And she started crying.
Oh.
Never forget it. She goes, I stopped having migraine headaches about a month ago.
Wow.
And so we were like 17-year-old, 18-year-old high school kids looking at each other like, is there a connection?
What happened? Right.
What is going on? You know, and we were pretty confident that these things are connected, you know, migraine headaches might, or, you know, physical symptomology apparently can be affected by, well, in this case, sitting around talking about philosophical ideas and helping each other.
Well, introspection of oneself. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had that experience. I left the country for a couple of years. I came back. The couple of years was going on an ecclesiastical mission for my church. And while I'm in Chile, I get a brochure through a connection and a connection, another connection, a brochure of this like a Xeroxed trifold piece of paper about a wilderness program. I'm like, what is that? What is it? And they didn't call it wilderness therapy back then.
No.
Wilderness survival program for
teens. Right, wilderness survival.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, well, this is, you know, interesting. And so a Sky Harbor Airport in Phoenix on the way to my hometown, you had to pass through Payson, Arizona. And Larry Olson had just gotten there about a year and a half earlier. And people had encouraged me to at least look into it. And so I go into his office and he's like, well, young man, you know, we need people, you know, and I'm like,
pioneer in our industry. Bless his heart.
Yeah. We could go on and on. You know, yeah. I played my flute at his funeral 2.5 years mm-hmm. ago. But anyway, he's like, we need staff. And I was not going to do it. I was like, I got to go to college because I got to get whatever the degree is you're supposed to have to become a psychologist. Or, you know, I still didn't even know the terms, you know, it's just psychologist is the only thing I knew. And then an odd set of events happened. And it had to do with the BYU admissions process. They called and said, well, you can't enroll this semester because your application fee didn't come through. And that's back when you could get checks back, you know, and there was a BYU stamp on the back of this check. And I called this lady and said, I'm holding a check that has the fee and a BYU stamp on the back of this check. And she goes, well, that may be so. I don't disbelieve you, but you still can't enroll this semester. So I called up Larry and I said, look, I need a job for a couple months. Is a couple months okay? And he goes, sure, that'll be fine. And I said, great. What do I need to do? And this is Larry Olson style, if you knew anything about him. He goes, well, do you got a knife? And I said, I can borrow one. He goes, I'll see you Tuesday at 10. That was it.
And the adventure begins.
So I grabbed an extra pair of socks and borrowed the knife. And I still wasn't going to do it. I did my training week. And I thought, this wilderness thing is stupid. Then this is the connection. About 5 days into my training week, we did this super ridiculously long hike. It was like 22 miles.
Wow.
And I remember falling on it about 2 a.m, just falling on the ground, and the boys that I was with just falling. And the one that was closest to, you know, kind of falling on the ground where I was in our bags, he goes, have you decided whether or not you're going to work here? And I said, no, I haven't decided yet, which was a complete lie. You know, I'm like, I'm out of here. And he goes, well, could you please just stay until I leave?
Oh.
And this flood, and first of all, I was like, damn it, you know, but this flood of, wait a minute, the same kind of changes and beautiful experience that I had back in high school doing this club thing is happening at the foot of these saguaro cactuses. And I'm exhausted and that part is different, but it's happening. Why is it happening?
Right.
Why, you know? And so I said, you know what? I'll stay here for, you know, whatever it is, a month and a half. And then again, Larry called me in the next week and he goes, we're doing this thing called a senior staff. Do you think you could commit for the summer? If we want you to be one of these senior staff. And I'm like, yeah, I think I can do that. And he goes, well, it's next week is when we're going to initiate this. I'm like, oh gosh. So I come back next week and he goes, there's this young woman who works at a different wilderness program. She's been there for, you know, a couple years. She's one of the directors there. And we're going to put her in your group so you can kind of, you know, let her know how this program is. And you say she's worked for two and a half years. I've worked 2.5 weeks. Tell her how things are. And he's like, well, yeah. And her name was Sherry Fisher at the time.
Uh-huh.
About 5 months later, her name became Sherry Gallagher.
There you go.
Yeah. So that's how that happened. And so that combination of events right there set the rest of this in motion. She knew what wilderness survival with teens was. She had an appreciation for it. And I worked in the wilderness for almost 1,500 days as a field instructor, as a married person with kids, because she understood what it was and how important it was. And she raised our kids during that time. And then it opened up the opportunity to help design that first program and a second and a third and, you know.
And here you are today.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, what an adventure. And we do have some questions for our listeners. And I think that can just feed into more of what you've been doing.
Okay.
Linda in Boulder says, what does it take to be a wilderness guide? You know, and what kind of training?
Okay, excellent. So I would say that the main crux of being a wilderness guide has less to do with training than it does how you have been sort of conducting your life in a way wherein a lot of that training is embedded, has been essentially embedded as part of who you are. So we work really hard to find people, and we have a recruiter slash screener who does a lot of work on the front end, interviewing and trying to get a feel for people. But we're looking for a handful of things that can also be trained. It's augmenting sort of who somebody might already be. One is being a mentor. If you've already had mentoring experience in your life, whether you're a parent or an older sibling, or you did a mentorship thing, or maybe something like I did in high school, you know, if you're a mentoring type person, we look for that, and we also train that. And then there's SAGE. So SAGE is just like a mentor, but having to do with a group of people, you know, teaching maybe a handful of people. Then there's guardian. I have titles for these. So guardian is one who is responsible, mature, can keep track of where people are constantly all the time. You know, and it's like protocols, you know, right, like the protocol freaks or the guardians. And then there's catalyst. These are people who are honest enough to give people feedback, but honest enough with themselves that their feedback is about that other person in service of them and not because they're just sort of got kind of hang up, you know. And so catalyst is important. You need to challenge people. And then spirit maker. This is somebody who can wrap up a group of people in terms of the ambiance of their experience. And we train heavily in that one. And then beckoner, which is somebody who knows how to become chosen by another person, especially a young person. And that has to do with personality, has to do with whether or not you can remain unoffended, basically. Like, don't take things personally, you know, the one of the four agreements. Like,
four agreements, right?
Yeah, you're just kind of like that. You know, that's a big piece. And that's actually a very big piece, because if you're not enough of a beckoner, then you will only get resistance if you try to be a catalyst, for example. And then the seventh one is seeker. So regardless of how old a person is or how much experience or how much of an education they have walking through our doors wanting to be a field guide, are they ready to continue their learning process? And without that, the other six aren't going to be as effective. So.
Well,
there you go.
You're very detailed in who you look for to be out in the field. Todd in Nebraska says, you know, when did you start working in wilderness and why have you stayed so long? So I think we heard about, you know, when you started, but here you are 30 some years later and you're still going.
Yeah. So it was 1990. And why I stayed so long is because I believe there are particular ways people heal from trauma. And I have experienced a significant amount of very personal internal trauma in my own life. And I've experienced healing in the wilderness. And in my opinion, there are very few contexts that can be found in the human experience that are more powerful or more efficient in helping somebody get past very deep, cutting, traumatic events in one's life that do that better than the wilderness, actually, especially for young people. And so I have become, you know, I don't know, like a long-term convert, so to speak.
Well, that's good that you're still here, because you definitely are making a difference. And yeah. I've seen that firsthand. Rachel in Vermont says, you know, how large is Wingate? How many students do you have and how many staff do you have?
Okay. So we actually have 38 students right now. In the summertime, we go up to about 60. We don't really want to get much bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And how many staff are there? So we have about 15 staff per rotation, and that goes up and down according to the year. Okay. So we maintain a particular staff to student ratio. So that just kind of goes up and down.
Okay. Yeah. Melinda in Texas says, you know, what do you do in wilderness? Is it all hiking?
So in our style of wilderness, which is itinerant, meaning they go out and they're out there the whole time, big chunks of it are hiking. I could take up this entire hour and three more talking about how hiking is not just hiking, by the way. You know, it's bilateral stimulation, it's contemplation, it's meditation, it's mindfulness, it's a grit, it's flow. It's so many things. There's a lot of science and there's a lot of tradition, anywhere from modern science having to do with some of those things I just mentioned, and then ancient science. I mean, monks would leave a monastery and just hike around the entire mountain right where the monastery is, take them 2.5 months, and they do nothing else except just hike around that mountain. And obviously, that's the hiking is not the way to fully describe it, right? But we do a lot of that. We also do what's called primitive living skills. So the types of skills that people who lived primitively in the wilderness that like they would use to live, we practice those. So if you come into one of our groups there, you may see that somebody made a backpack or moccasins or a fire set, and they're working on fire or beadwork or a flute or, you know,
yeah, the necklaces that they wear that they add to that. I've
yep. Seen. Yeah. Yep. There you go.
Rick in California says, what ages do you accept at Wingate?
13 through 17 for our adolescent populations, boys and girls are all identifications. And then young adults, 18 through about 26, we'll go higher than that, kind of case on case by case basis.
Okay. And Caroline in Maryland says, you know, what have you learned about yourself from working in wilderness for so long? I don't have enough time for that.
Yeah. Wow. So one of the things I've learned is that I need so much more to learn. It seems like, you know, I used to hear old people say this, you know, they're my age. Anyway, I've learned enough to know that I don't know anything. And I think that to the degree that we make assumptions, to the degree that we think we know, we're actually might be going backwards, but that's sort of an ethereal thing. Specifically, I've learned that in the wilderness, because of the things that I did, I know I can overcome so many more other things. So I learned grit in a huge way. And I don't use the word grit to mean like strong, but like this tough, like a internal toughness. You know, yeah. You hear of people that make it through, you know, ridiculous situations. And that's where it is. It's like this toughness that comes from the middle of them. And I feel that in me when I think about my wilderness experience. That's helpful. So that's one thing I've learned.
One of many. Monica here in Colorado says, how has wilderness changed in the last 30 years?
Whew.
So
a lot. Yeah. So in terms of wilderness therapy itself, it's gone from kind of this older school, very similar to the version that we do now.
Bootcamp model.
Yeah. So way back, you had two things going on. One, kind of a pure wilderness survival experience that was built to be very quiet, silent, calm, kind, healing, inviting. And that was where I got brought up in. And then you had sort of people who had come from kind of a militaristic side of things. And they added things like pack drills and time limits and level systems and rather odd things, in my opinion, that don't really fit with wilderness. They fit with military training, but they don't really fit with wilderness. So that that second one has started to go away. Not entirely, by the way.
Right. There are still some places.
Yeah. It's got some work to do.
Georgia, Mississippi, Kentucky, kind of, yeah. Some of the backwood places are still some of that aggressive wilderness.
Yep. And so there's still some work to do there. And then of the kind that I just described, that's still alive in the form of two or three programs that are kind of holding on to the kind of the older ways of doing things. And then there's newer versions that have to do with hybrid wilderness and residential and base camp and, mm-hmm. and recreation and different things like that. In terms of students and how that's changed is, we used to get a lot of oppositional defiance, kind of just good old fashioned, and a lot of other symptomology that nowadays we would call the results of trauma or a developmental trauma that back then we also labeled as oppositionality.
Right, because people didn't talk about trauma. It wasn't recognized and wasn't even really discussed in many families.
Yep.
This is bad behavior.
Yeah, it's all about behavior. And so now what I really love about what's happening now is the way some of us did things in the wilderness way back in the day was 100% trauma responsive. And so we're still doing some of those things. It's not changed. Like, see these children as people. Be kind whenever you can. Don't make them jump through hoops, but acknowledge them when they make the changes that are coming from them, deep inside of them that manifest, and now acknowledge that. A lot of things like that.
Lewis in Colorado says, who has been your mentor on this journey of being in wilderness for so long? And I know you mentioned Larry Olson, but there must have been others too along the way.
Number one is a woman by the name of Sherry Loreen Gallagher. originally Fisher. So she had almost a decade worth of experience in between recreation and wilderness survival and different things, but also just working with kids for 2.5 some odd years in this kind of setting. And she had a lot of insight to give me. Then ironically, the person who took the place, my father's position at the high school as the art teacher. So this is before I even got into wilderness. He interjected into my life, inviting me to kind of choose him to be my mentor by teaching me how to make a sling, David and Goliath type sling.
Okay. And
I think I've probably taught a couple thousand sling. I demonstrated sling today.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's still with you today.
Yeah.
Alan in California says, what is your favorite part about what you do? And what is your least favorite part?
My favorite part is going to the wilderness and still digging around in the sand, being in the dirt. I'm a born field staff, and I will always love that piece. I also like this kind of thing that we're doing right now. I think telling the message of the style of wilderness that we do and keeping alive. I feel like I'm a memory keeper in a lot of ways, and I enjoy that. What I do not enjoy is thinking about EBITDA and spreadsheets and business model-y type stuff. I've had to learn that, and I've had to get at it, and you have to do that, and that's great, and I don't like it.
Yeah, I can relate. Kimberly in Idaho says, do more men than women work in wilderness?
You know, it's interesting. It certainly has pivoted over the years. In director positions, you would think there would be far more men than women, but there's a good cadre of women that work. I would say that it's still probably overrepresented by men, but it's more presented by women than you think it would, you know, if you think like wilderness or whatever. Two of the most influential, three of the most influential people of this whole industry that have been executive directors and VPs of divisions and all that are women. Like that, there's very few that have as much experience as them. Sherry has an enormous amount of experience and has led programs and organizations in wilderness therapy. And I'm a big supporter of it. I believe that women have a very distinct influence out in the wilderness, including, and adolescent girls would tell adolescent boys to just shut the hell up and stop complaining regularly. And the reverse very rarely happens.
Really?
Like, women are tougher. They're tougher. And they turn a wilderness experience into almost like a home, just automatically. I love seeing what one would classify as a weak, petite, soft-spoken little girl out in the wilderness, because she annihilates. They really do. And
now the groups are single gender when they're adolescents. Is that correct?
Yeah, most of the time ours are.
And then co-ed when they're young adults.
Yeah, the young adults are co-ed. And even now, you know, young adult women, you know, they tend to be the tough ones of the group and kind of in charge in a lot of ways. And so it's wide open in terms of who, if it's a job you want to have as a woman.
Right.
My clinical director is a woman.
Yep. She's amazing.
Yep. And she's one of the top, considered one of the top clinicians in the industry right now. So there you go.
Beth in California says, what is the best age to send your child to wilderness? How do you know if they might be too young, like 12, or 17 and a half too old?
So this is where you would engage the help of what we call an education consultant. But if I were to kind of riff on that a little bit, I wish I would have encountered wilderness therapy as about a 12 to 13 year old myself, maybe 11.
Do you think it's because they soak up more information?
It's all, your filters are down. There's very little ego. And it's like, you're telling me that's the way it is. Well, that must be the way it is. I'm the boss of my destiny. Right on, you know?
Right.
And it also tends to prelude a severe amount of common trauma that happens from about 12 to 17, especially for young women. And so I think early age is great, depending on the sort of program you send them to. You can't have this outside in behavioral modification kind of nonsense for the littler kids. It has to be very, very relational. But if all that kind of thing is in place, you know, a 12 to 13 year old knowing how to start a fire with sticks, are you kidding me? That is a unicorn rarity, and they know it, you know, internally, like, I am amazing.
Right. Look what I just did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then of course the same thing with the 17 year olds, but for different reasons. You know, if they haven't yet been in wilderness therapy, this is a perfect time to do it. You know, and now we're seeing 19, 20, 21, 24, 26, you know, and I've talked to 25 year olds multiple times. You're like, oh my gosh, if I could have done this 7 years ago, how different everything would be.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mike from Hawaii says, has there ever been any accidents in wilderness?
Absolutely. There's been, I would say, just a lot of accidents over I think we're going on about 33 years now for classic wilderness therapy, the way we see it now in terms of it being longer than about 21 days, you know, and that kind of thing. A lot of accidents. Having said that, wilderness therapy has better stats than vending machines. Like, they literally looked it up and did the math. And you're more likely to have an accident. There is more likelihood for an accident to happen with vending machines and school sports. Those are two that I know of than wilderness therapy now.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, sports is a very high risk situation in many areas, and wilderness is very safe. I mean, you do provide a lot of preventive measures. There's a lot of training that goes into keeping people safe. I think a lot of times people have this vision that the kids are just out there fending for themselves, and that's not the case.
Yeah. And then there's also, you know, I would say in normal American life, 14 to 17 year old females who have a desire to be liked, going out to parties with older boys and college kids. Do accidents sometimes happen?
Well, driving fast cars, roller skating or skateboarding down the middle of the street at night on a dare. So many things can happen.
Yeah, you describe the scenario, and it's probably going to be more unsafe than wilderness therapy. Yeah.
Jeremy in Canada says, can a child from Canada come to wilderness in the U.S.?
Short answer, if the parents figure it out.
Okay.
Yes. We've had Canadian
children. I mean, so, you know, children from, you know, I had a client from England who came over and went to wilderness.
We've had children from Colombia, Panama, Mexico, Perth, Australia, Singapore, Spain, all over the world.
Okay. So it's just really parents trying to figure out how to make that happen.
They need to figure out how to make it happen depending on the situation. And Kuwait was particularly difficult for a set of parents, but they did it.
Wow. That's amazing. Good for them. Suzanne in Colorado says, are there wilderness programs for those that are older, like in their late 40s?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. I actually get it from parents a lot.
Can I go? Right.
Yeah, you got one for somebody.
I know. So
in the last couple of years, we've actually taken out a 52-year-old and a 45-year-old. That's typically a little more expensive because there's
you have to do, you can't have them in your regular group, so to speak.
Yeah, it's a one-on-one usually.
Right. Okay.
So we had a mom who was 51, and her boy, her young adult son was in the wilderness. And about halfway through his stay, she called the therapist and said, look, these letters coming from my boy are ridiculous. This is the most positive thing that's ever happened in his life. I myself have lived through a lot of trauma. I want to come out and I want to graduate the same day he does.
Oh, wow.
And so we did that.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing. So it does happen. We do it actually, but again, it's a little more expensive. It's a case by case situation and that whole thing.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. As you're thinking about that, Suzanne, give Shane a call. George in Alaska says, what's the hardest part for a student in wilderness and what's the easiest part?
The hardest part is probably the first week.
Yeah.
And the easiest part is not the last, not the end, not the last week, like you would probably think my answer would be, but kind of about 75% of the way through.
Yeah.
And it gets easier in some ways towards the end, but what happens towards the end is there's this thing of, okay, I got to enter the rest of, you know, the rest of my life now. And so that can get a little bit difficult, but it's good difficult, if that makes sense. Unnecessary. Well, maybe it is necessary. It's difficulty because of what's going on inside of the kiddo for the first week or two or three. And then afterwards, the wilderness hasn't changed. Conditions haven't changed. Food hasn't changed. Nothing's changed. But the kiddo is like, this is cool now. I'm good. Like, it's all fine now. You know, I just talked with a young adult male 2 days ago, and he is 18 and years and about a month old now. But he came to us 3 weeks before his 18th birthday.
Okay.
And my first conversation with him was like, I'm not staying. No, I'm staying. 18th birthday, I'm out of here. My second conversation with him, when now he's about a week and a half from his birthday, he's like, I don't know, maybe I'll give it a shot. And 2 days ago, he's like, I am so glad I didn't give up or, you know, wimp out or, you know, give myself the disfavor of leaving. He goes, I thought about it a couple times. He goes, but I'm making it. I'm making it. I'm going to do this. And he's very proud of who he is right now.
And we've, you know, you mentioned how wilderness used to be like 21 days. What is the average length of stay now, Shane?
For us, it's 64 days.
Okay.
Yeah. In wilderness therapy in general, I would say it's probably in the neighborhood of 80-ish.
Okay.
Like that.
Yeah. Okay. And how has COVID, you know, affected the wilderness situation?
When COVID first came out and everybody was really afraid, we saw a little bit of a dip, but that ended quickly because I think everybody logically supposed that it's hard to get COVID out in the
absolutely.
So we've been okay as a business, you know, and we've had two staff get it and two students get it in the whole time it's been going on. And none of them knew it at the time, by the way. It's just because they were tested.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Kelly in Nevada says, what do parents do while their child is in wilderness? Is their family work?
Yeah. So We invite, I mean, upon enrollment, we give parents a library and a hierarchy in terms of importance of which books to read first.
Okay.
And some of these books are the same ones that their child is reading. So a common language will begin to be built as well. Because, I mean, we all know that, you know, it's not going to be just this isolated child that is struggling. If for nothing else, the trauma, let's say it's a perfect family, you know, in any other context, these kids are being raised amazingly, yay, but a traumatic event happens in a young person's life and their behavior starts to, like, you know, become problematic, that actually has an effect on the family as well. And then maybe some of the issues that this family never really had because everybody was okay, now it's all coming live.
Right.
Sometimes parents' issues get manifested that would have never really been manifested had this difficulty not come up. And so now everybody's issues are alive, and we feel that it's our job, and a lot of wilderness programs feel like it's their job to help everybody understand this entire family unit dynamic. And so books and seminars and intensives, we have a parent coach and a therapist that works with the parents, the same one that works with the child. But the parent coach is independent of that. We do family intensives. We do a family 4-day weekend starting this summer, something crazy happens. Yeah. And so it's an integral piece. And even if you didn't do all that extra stuff, just the fact that these parents have a kiddo in the wilderness and what you have parents do themselves is a big piece. It's like there's a lot of emotional leverage going on.
So much emotional stuff going on.
Yeah.
I think the kids are starting to share things that parents didn't know about, which is explaining why some of their choices were what they were. And I've also seen that parents have divulged information that they were withholding from their child that was affecting the family dynamic. And, you know, people don't realize that keeping those secrets is damaging.
Yep. I was teaching our family seminar once years ago, and one of the moms kind of just said something like, whoa, you know, during the middle of it, you know, and all heads turn, you know, to her. And she goes, I just had a realization. This is not about my relationship with my daughter. This is about my relationship with my mom.
Oh.
And so these little lights that come on, you know, when our life gets hard because of what our kids do, often we realize that we have a lot of unresolved issues. And that's good. That's a good thing.
It's a good thing because it's a new place to start and do some healing work. Ron in California says, what issues are addressed in wilderness? Is addiction addressed?
Addiction is addressed hugely, and a lot of different kinds of addiction.
There's so many kinds of addictions, right? So
all kinds of process and gaming and gambling and all kinds of, and then your classic, you know, substance addiction. And in my opinion, and there's a lot of science that points to this these days, you probably won't have addiction without having trauma somewhere. Little T, a lot of little T's or a big T or whatever trauma. And so you, by addressing the one thing, you're kind of addressing the other. If you address depression circumspectly, you're probably going to address addiction too, or, a failing of grades just by addressing depression circumspectly, wholly. So we work with those things that I just mentioned, and then also, you know, bipolar.
Adoption, attachment.
A lot of adoption, a lot of all kinds of attachment issues. Good old-fashioned oppositionality still, even though we all know that that's really not just what it is. So a lot of things. I mean, it's more what we don't treat, you know, a conduct disorder. What we don't treat is kind of higher level, what you would think maybe a psychiatric hospital might be more appropriate. So high level conduct disorder, suicide attempt, like a recent attempt, not just a kind of ideation around it. Violence at a level where we're thinking that, you know, somebody might, you know, take a swing at somebody else. We can't deal with that in remote settings.
Right.
Oh gosh. And then health things, you know, that would just prevent somebody. We don't do type 1 diabetes, for example. There are programs that do that.
What about weight? You know, I know that parents have sometimes been concerned that their child might be obese and not mm-hmm. physically able to handle a wilderness program. Is there a...
Yeah. So weight is an amazing thing in terms of a wilderness therapy experience. We've had kids who come in and that are too skinny and they actually gain weight. And then we have to do therapy work with the mom that's upset that their daughter gained weight into healthy levels of weight. So that's this whole process. But by and large, in terms of weight, we will get children who will go into the healthy range before they leave almost every single time, regardless of what their BMI is when they come here. We can't take a certain level. About 41 is about as high a BMI as we can take. Except in the winter, sometimes we can take a little bit higher.
Different weather. Yeah.
And it also depends on activity level, because sometimes a person's BMI is pretty high, but they have a lot of activity. They're actually in pretty good shape considering. And so we take that into account as well.
And one of the last questions we have is from Thomas in California. It says, do you think you will ever slow down and want to do something else?
Who is this person? You know, I have thought of that. Yes. I've thought of doing other things, maybe in a coaching capacity and things like that. I've also thought of reorganizing in such a way where I'm not, you know, so involved in every day-to-day thing. And I've almost accomplished that. So I do a lot of marketing and I still go to the field. And I don't know. I think now I'm going to be 92 and I'll still want to go to the field. You know, like, Mr. Gallagher, you're going to die in about 2 years. Well, I better make it to the field in a year from now, at least. That's probably what's going to happen.
Another book to be written, Shane?
I do, actually. There's some Western ways of approaching a lot of Eastern things. And I started with the base of my version of the Tao Te Ching. But there's ways to describe a lot of the concepts. There's about 17 distinct concepts in the Tao Te Ching in terms of working with children that there's a book behind that.
Great. Well, let's make sure that people know how to reach you, what your website is, your phone number, who they call for more information. Especially I know with the weather getting nice and the summer months coming, you get full. And I think people are starting to think about what happens now that school is ending. So go ahead and let's share that information with them.
Okay. So our website is WingateWildernessTherapy.com. So you can always get on there. We have a phone number on there as well. You can, people are free to email me at Shane, Shayne, @WingateTherapy.com. Okay. And the phone number for us, besides the one that's on the website, is 1-417-880-1369.
Okay.
Yeah. You can call that number. And what else is it? Was that it?
Yeah. Website, phone number. And you're located in Kanab, Utah.
Kanab, Utah. Yeah. And by the way, the amount of people that come from the world to the Kanab, Utah area is only growing. We see people from all over the planet because we're right smack in the middle of the Grand Canyon and Zion National Park and Bryce Canyon National Park and Glen Canyon National Park. It's ridiculous.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Great place to be. Well, I'm so glad that you were able to be here today. I think there's still so much more that we could talk about. I would welcome the opportunity to have you come back again.
I'd be happy to.
Yeah. And I look forward to coming out and seeing you maybe in the fall, Aspen and I.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, Dori, if this is said very often, because I don't know if you've done a radio talk show with yourself, but
with myself.
If I were to do it with you, I would ask you questions about about navigating this world, having been a survivor of a lot of things and of trauma and of hardship and what it's like to be a healer in this world, because
I should have you interview me for a show.
Okay.
Okay. We'll have to talk about that.
All right.
Be happy to. Next week, we're going to have David Plush on the show. And David is a real estate agent. And he's going to talk about home ownership and buying and selling. And I know that we've had a lot of requests for that information. So we'll look forward to David Plush being with us next week. And I always leave the show with a saying. This one comes from a Joseph Campbell companion book. It says, "What did you do as a child that created timelessness, that made you forget time?" And I just did that this last week. I spent 5 days in Steamboat Springs, and I have to say it was great to not have to be watching time and to just be. So enjoyed that very much. Thank you, everyone, for being here, for listening to Every Voice Matters every Thursday, 12 noon, out in time. I look forward to seeing you all next week. Take care.
You're listening to Every Voice Matters with Dori Francis, only on LA Talk Radio.